Well, my name is Zach Thompson. I'm on staff here at Calvary Bible Church, but you could tell what my name is because of my super snazzy name tag that I'm wearing. We announced that we were going to do Name Tag Sunday, the last Sunday of every month back in June. We're just getting all the same months mixed up. Back in January, we said that we're going to do that. And then it just so happened that I missed every single Sunday of Name Tag Sunday. The staff would say that it's not so much of a coincidence, but I'm so happy to be with you all finally for a Name Tag Sunday. The verse that links where we were last week in Nehemiah chapter 9 and where we are this week in Nehemiah 10 is, what did you know, at the very last word said in Nehemiah chapter 9. This is verse 38. Let me read this for us. It says, because of all this, hang on to that phrase, because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing on the sealed documents are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. So they say, because of all this. So all that came before, when they looked at God's faithfulness, when they read the law, when they saw their own faithlessness, as they were focusing on who God is, on what he's done, because of all of that, they decide to make a covenant with their God. Now, probably before we go too much further, we should define our terms. What is a covenant? Well, just a really simple definition of a covenant is that it is a binding promise that intertwines two parties. A binding promise that intertwines two parties. So binding promise, it is saying that each party of that is going to do something, but it's not some mere light commitment like, I guess I'll do it. No, this is a binding promise. You even see that with what the Israelites talk about. They say, we are entering into this oath and a curse. Let there be consequences. It says, let us be punished if we do not keep our side of things. That's not a mere light commitment. It is a binding promise that they will do something. But it also intertwines two parties. You see this a lot as covenants were made between nations or kings. They would show up. They would exchange gifts. They would say what they're promising to do for each other. They would say what the punishment for being keeping those promises. But they also were joining in together. Your benefit is my benefit. The good that comes to you brings good for me as well. They are linked together in this way. And here are the people of God turning to God saying, we are joining in with you. We are linking ourselves to you. Where we might look to other places for support or guidance or care, we are finding that in you. As we look at the promises being kept, God has already revealed himself to be faithful. God has kept his side. And so the people are saying, we are going and doing what you call us to do that's for our good and for your glory. Then following that, we hear of the people that are part of this covenant, those who sign this this document. And wouldn't you know it, in the book of Nehemiah, we have another list of people. And here we have this list that's broken down into kind of three different categories. There's the priests, there's the Levites, and there's the leaders outside of the church, the leaders of the people that starts off chapter 10. Now, in no way is this an exhaustive list. It's not as though Jim didn't show up on time and so he gets to live his life however he wants because he's not signing this thing. No, they are representing all of the people. All of the Israelites are entering into this covenant, this binding promise that intertwines both of them. But the names are given to us to show us that this is a public commitment that they're doing. Yes, it's personal. They individually are joining themselves to God, but publicly, they are announcing this is what we're all going to do. We're all going to do this. It shows the seriousness of it, but it also shows the accountability that they're entering into with each other. We're all going to help each other keep this covenant. This day that we're reading about in Nehemiah chapter 10, where the people are announcing all that they're going to do, it's not a mere moment in history. It's not a day that they look back on, hey, wasn't that day cool that we made that promise with God? This is the starting point of how they are relating with him. This is the moment that begins them faithfully living out this covenant that they have with him. A pastor that I like put it this way, he described it through the lens of a marriage, which is another type of covenant. He said, imagine that there's a spouse who doesn't show any commitment to the marriage, that they don't show any love or support for their spouse. And when you ask them about it, they say, look, I made a vow to you on our wedding day. I'll let you know if anything changes. they aren't living as part of that covenant. We demonstrate that we are part of a covenant by faithfully living as we said we would live each and every day out of it. God has revealed himself to be faithful. He's kept his end of the bargain. He has kept his side of the covenant. So he calls his people to be faithful. We've seen already in chapter 7 and 10 that God calls his people to be faithful by his word. That it's in how he's revealed himself that we know who this God is, that we see that he's been faithful, that we can draw near to him, intertwine with him, be connected with him. We see God call his people to be faithful through confession. We saw this last week in chapter 9, that we don't keep our side perfectly. And so we confess those things to God, with and to each other. And this week we continue the idea that God calls his people to be faithful in being distinct. God calls his people to be faithful in being distinct. We see this quite physically happen as the Israelites make this covenant. It says that they separated themselves from those of the other nations. They are making themselves distinct. But in everything that they promise to do, everything that they say they will do in this covenant, just goes further and further to make them different, to make them distinct from those around. See, the idea is that when we know who our God is, when we see how faithful he's been, when we live out of that, that causes us to live in a way, to interact with the world, to interact with others, that is different. That is distinct from those around us. It starts off with the first thing that they promise to do. In verse 29, they say, "We will keep all of your commands, God." That's something that's different. This isn't something that comes instinctual for us. You don't stumble upon a random tribe that no one's heard of before and they are accidentally following all of God's commands. This takes work. This is different than how people tend to live. Verse 30, they say they will not intermarry with the other nations. That's not a racial reason. There is a religious component to this. People would marry from different races and they would bring their religion, different people, and they would bring their gods with them. And Israel says, we will not do that. We will be different in this way. We will be distinct. This idea of living faithfully for God that makes his people distinct is something that we see in the early church as well. That in the years where Christianity was expanding, people were taking note of it. I think of there was a first, second century Roman statesman slash lawyer named Pliny the Younger, who was talking about the Christians, just how awful and weird they are. He says that they bind themselves by oaths. They make a covenant with each other not to do some crime, but not to commit fraud or theft or adultery, not to falsify their trust, nor to refuse to return trust when called upon to do so. I mean, these guys sound awful. They're joining together to do good things? That's so weird and different. But God's people being distinct, it was causing others to take notice, to see that something was different about them. In light of who God is, the life that his people live is distinct. There's a couple different ways that this continues to show up in the passage, ways that the Israelites were called to be distinct that I think show up in how we can be distinct in a similar way as we seek to follow our God. And the first thing that we see in this passage is that the Israelites, in light of who their God is, was called to be distinct in how they use their time. Distinct in how they use their time. Verse 31 says, "We will keep the Sabbath. One day a week, we will not do any work." And this is different from how the other nations around them would have used their time. See, the idea at the time is if you didn't work, you didn't eat. And so for them to take an entire day where they did not do any work was showing that we do not trust in our labor, but we put our trust in our God. And that's something that's distinct. I think we can use time in a similar way. I mean, things are certainly different. We have weekends now. There's time that's set aside to where we aren't going to work. But it's really easy for our weekends to just be full of stuff. We are committed to a lot of different things. There's parties and planning ahead. There's shopping for the week. There's games and practices. There's get-togethers. There's just a lot of commitments that happen during our weekend. Imagine if we used our time differently. It would be drastically distinct in our culture to not schedule our weekend to death. You don't have your kid in 400 activities? Wow, don't you care about them? No, we do care about them. And this is why we don't put pressure upon them with an overfull schedule. Instead, we trust in our God and that their future is safe and secure in his hands. We get time to be together as a family, to rest, to recharge, to praise our God who's given us everything that we have. You aren't going to come to my cat's birthday party? Wow, I thought you cared about me. I mean, I do care about you. So much so. Your cat, not at all, but I'm going to miss spending time with you. It's so special to get to spend time with you, but I've been going and going and going as if I have endless energy, as if I have complete control over my days, and I need time to pause, to pray, to praise my God who's given me what I have. In our culture, we are committed to so many different things that if we stopped doing even some of those things, that would be distinct. That would be different. And we do so. We use our time in a way that understands that God is the one in control. God has given us what we have. And as we use our time that way, people take notice. People might get upset that we use time in that way. But I think as well, it can be a light to the world. That as we understand what we have comes from God, we live out of that reality, that we trust him, that our future's safe in his hands, that that's our understanding of how we use time. Starts to help others to see what is the greatest commitment that they have as well. And that's the God who's given us what we have. The Israelites as well were distinct in how they used money. They were distinct in how they used money. Kind of a longer passage, but I want us to get the scope of this. So stick with me on this. I'm going to pick it up in Nehemiah chapter 10, starting at verse 32. It says, we take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel, so a certain amount of money that they're giving, for the service of the house of our God. And what that money's going for, it's for the showbread, the regular grain offering, the regular burnt offering, the Sabbaths, the new moons, the appointed feasts, the holy things, and the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel and for all the work of the house of our God. We, the priests, the Levites, and the people, so everybody, it's not just for the professionals, but every person, have likewise cast lots for the wood offering to bring it to the house of our God according to our fathers' houses at times appointed year by year to burn on the altar of the Lord our God, as was written in the law. We obligate ourselves to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of the fruit of every tree year by year to the house of the Lord. Also to bring to the house of our God, to the priests who minister in the house of our God, the firstborns of our son and our cattle. Really quickly, they're not sacrificing their kids. It could be read that way. If you go to Exodus, they talk about kids are a blessing to us, so we offer something when we receive a firstborn. That's what it's talking about. No kid sacrifice happening right here. But they bring the firstborn of our sons and of our cattle as written in the law and the firstborn of our herds and of our flocks. And to bring the first of our dough and our contributions, the fruit of every tree, the wine, the oil, to the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and to bring to the Levites the tithes from our ground. For it's the Levites who collect the tithes in all of our towns where we labor. And the priests, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites receive the tithes, and the Levites shall bring upon the tithe of the tithes to the house of our God, to the chamber of the storehouses. For the people of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of grain, wine, and oil to the chambers, where the vessels of the sanctuary are, as well as the priests who minister, and the gatekeepers and the singers. We will not neglect the house of our God. All right, a lot going on in there. But just to simply summarize what's happening, they are saying, we will willingly, we will take the obligation to fulfill what God has called us to do. We will generously give of all of these things so that the work of God can take place. They're going to give objects for sacrifices. They're going to give wood so that those sacrifices could be sacrificed. They're giving of money so that resources could be purchased to care for those who are working in the temple. That all of these things that God has called them to give, they are saying, we are willingly doing this so that the work of God can continue. It's not that they're contributing. They're not building the temple. But they're doing all the things so that the work of the temple can take place. And this is a distinct way of utilizing and using resources and finances. This is willingly living off of less. Less fruit, less crops, less animals and animal products, less wood, less money. It is willingly living off of less, and that is radically distinct. I think it's distinct in our culture as well. So much of our interaction with money comes down to just the simple phrase, it is mine. I earn this by the sweat of my brow, by the carpal tunnel of my wrist. I have earned this, so I will use it as I see fit. Now, in no way is this saying that people outside the church are not generous. Of course they are. But even in giving, so much of that is focused on me. I think that this organization is doing some good, so I want to support that. I feel good when I help others. And all of this, it's focused on what I am receiving and how I use my money. So why would someone willingly go off of less if there's no perceived benefit of it? Well, remember, this is coming. We got to get the order right of this. This is coming after the Israelites spent an entire chapter saying, this is what God has done. This is how he's been faithful. Here's how he provided for us. Here's how he's cared for us. Here's how he gave us all that we have when we had nothing. It's constantly going back to God, you've been faithful. God, you've been faithful. God, you've been faithful. And so their understanding and our understanding is that every good thing that we have comes from God. And so there is no place for this is mine because none of it's mine. It's all been given to me. And that radically changes. We use money in a distinct way when we recognize that everything that we have comes from the God who's faithfully provided for us. That is distinct. And so we see the Israelites here, and I read the whole passage so we can see this is something very planned. This is meticulous. Maybe we zoned out for a little bit. I think I zoned out for a little bit in the section there. I was stumbling over words. It is very long, but it's showing the intentionality and planning the Israelites take to be generous in response to God's generosity. They put a plan in place. They have the times that they will collect money, times that they will collect resources, who they're giving things to. It's this whole system that they have in place to use money in a distinct way. Now we get to things a little bit different in the New Testament. It's not so regimented. There's no specific rules into how much of things are supposed to be given. God gave those in the Old Testament to show generosity so we don't have dependence on him, so that we can learn to respond to his faithfulness. But in the New Testament, we see things lessened and deepened in different ways. That the New Testament's teaching on money and how we are distinct and how we use them boil down to two words: generosity and stewardship. So stewardship is what we'll focus on there, that God has entrusted us. We are responsible for different things. We have family and friends. We have things to care for. We have bills. We have money that we owe to people. We are good stewards of where God has us to care for what we're responsible for. But the other side of that is generosity, that we are called not so much to focus on a number to reach, but a heart position to take. That we're called to be generous towards those that God has around us. I think of Jesus teaching with this widow who comes up to the temple who just has two coins. That's all she has. Everyone around her giving more. And yet Jesus focuses on the woman who gives two coins because that's what she has. She was generous. Or I think as well about how nonsensical would it be for a Christian to have someone alongside them say, hey, I'm really suffering, I'm really struggling, could you help me out, to go, you know, I've already given 10% this month, so hit my quota, maybe try me next month. It's ridiculous to think about that, right? It's focused on the heart position that we're called to do. But wherever we are in God's word, New Testament or old, we see this intentionality, this desire to respond to God's generosity with generosity in turn, to be part of the work that God is doing. This is setting out with an intentional plan. The Israelites bring their first fruits, the first that they have, making this a priority in their life. It's not something that they stumble into. They don't get to a place of giving, you know, if we have some margin this month, then maybe we can look into it. This is intentionally focusing on responding to God's generosity by being generous in return, to being part of the work that God is doing by using money in a distinct way. I've shared before about how Emily and I try to be generous with our time, to try to be good stewards with what's been given to us. I consider myself to be a pretty strong budgeter, and so that we can make sure that we're covering our needs so that we can hopefully get to wants that we have. This becomes all the more important as I work at a church, Emily works at a school, we carry quite a bit of student debt, so we need to work hard to be good stewards of what has been given to us. Now, I don't know if it's the same for other people here who budget well, but I didn't get into it because of a particular gift set that I have, or because I just love reminding my wife to input receipts. That's just my joy in life. I started budgeting out of fear. I primarily view money through the lens of fear. That when things get really difficult, when they're hard, my instinct is not to be generous, but it's to clench, to hold on to what we have as tight as we have, you know, just in case. It's what I can do to try to take control. Things are going wrong, so I need to try to fix it. My instinct is to not be generous. And this is part of the beauty of automatic payments, so that it could be a way for us to do first fruits. On the first of the month, we have an automatic payment going out to Calvary, to missionaries that we support, to other organizations that we believe in are doing great work for the gospel. We do all this right at the beginning so that when later on in the month, when things start to get tight or difficult, I don't give in to my instinct to not be generous. That when we get a massive vet bill and a maternity ward bill on the same day that our student loans are due, that I don't give in to my instinct to just clench and hold on and put my trust in myself rather than the God who's given me everything to begin with. Now, I still need to work on that heart piece, that generosity. That's something I still need to continue to work on. But it's a way that we try to put our focus on what God has called us to do, to live in a distinct way with how we deal with finances. Where it's so easy to go to, this is mine when things are hard. We understand that God has given us everything, and that changes who we are and how we deal with money. And we see that with the Israelites. We've talked about that they are struggling, that they gave up time working on their jobs to go and build the wall, that they have these increased taxes from Persia. They are in a difficult time, and they say, we will do all this. We will put this obligation on ourselves. We will give all of this. We will use money in this distinct way because there's no better way to respond to the ever-faithful God than to participate in the work that he's doing in this way. But it's not just the giving of their money that made them distinct. They were distinct in their worship as well. The Israelites were distinct in their worship. They used their time and energy and efforts to join in God's work. They didn't just roll up, cut a check, and say, well, that's my job done. They used all that they had to join in the work that God was doing. Because think of that passage that we read. Think of how many action items were in there. They go and gather the tithe. They go and gather the wood. They do all of this to be part of the work of the house of our God. They use all that they have to be part of the work of the house of our God, to join in what he is doing. I think we see this quite clearly back to chapter 3, where everyone is out there building the wall together, and we get this whole list of the people who are doing it. Everybody joins together to be part of this work that God has called them to do. And it doesn't just so happen that, man, they have so many people who are gifted in building walls. It just so happens that all of them have this skill set. No, we're told this list of who these people building the walls are. We're told that goldsmiths are out there. Not a lot of translation between building walls and doing the fine detail artwork of goldsmithing. Or my favorite one, we're told that there's a perfumer there building the wall. This is what it looks like when God's people come together to use what they have to be part of the work that God is doing. And I think we have a similar call here as well. To use our time, our energy, our efforts to be part of God's work that he is doing here in his place. I mean, imagine what it would look like to work all week and you finally get a day off and you spend an hour of it with elementary school students here. Imagine what it would be like to have a really hard work day on a Wednesday, and you have just enough time to scarf down dinner before you invest in high school students and middle school students. Imagine you finally get a day to sleep in, but you're here on at 7 a.m. to run sound or play bass. Why would someone live this way? Why would they give up so much for this? Because God calls perfumers to build walls. That he brings us together to use what we have, our whole lives, to live lives of worship as we join in with the work that God is doing in his place. Now, I bring all these things up of us being distinct in these ways, not as a way to poke fun at anyone or for anyone to leave here beaten up. Then maybe we're here this morning, we undergive, we overschedule, our interaction with church is we're there for the service and we're out the door as soon as the last song is over. And that's all that we do at God's place. None of this is to poke at wounds or to make anyone feel bad, or definitely not to pile on shame on how we need to be doing better. I mentioned earlier to some of the staff that today doesn't feel great because it feels very much so like one of the most hypocritical times that I've been up here before. So what would it look like if we don't overcommit ourselves over a weekend? I say coming out of my weekend where I just overcommit to myself more than usual. What does it look like to use money in a way that's distinct? Well, that whole section about how Emily and I do things, I read that to Emily on Friday because I was having a meltdown about finances, that, or at least the potential of what a financial situation could look like in the fall. I bring all this stuff up because we are imperfect people trying to live faithfully for God. And we hold each other accountable to this. We support each other in this. We help each other to spur one another on to keep our side of what God's called us to in light of who God is. None of this is try harder. None of this is you need to be doing better. We keep the order of what we see in this book. It all starts with looking first at God's faithfulness. He has been faithful in our lives. He has revealed himself to be generous. He has revealed himself to be with us, guiding us, protecting us along the way. It is as we see our God is like that, that our lives are shaped, that we live in light of the reality of who our God is. And that is what makes us distinct. From there, and only from there, not off of our efforts, but off of who our God is, it might look like incorporating small pieces at a time, ways that we can encourage each other to live faithfully as God called us to live. Maybe it's going home after today and ensuring that the rest of the day is focused on rest and worship as well. We have a lot of things to do. There's things on our calendar. We got to get ready for the week. And God has certainly called us to be good stewards of what he's entrusted us with, but it's so easy to go from that tippy point of God's given me this to do to I am in control of all that happens. So what does it look like to be distinct? To use our Sunday as a time to rest and respond to the God who's ultimately in control. For some of us, it might be looking at our finances to see what does generosity and stewardship look like in our lives. For others, it's looking at our calendar to see where is there a place where I can join in the work of God's place to participate in the work that he is doing here. And these things sound scary. I mean, how do we find the money or the time or the energy or the efforts to add one more thing on? How do we find it within our schedule to just do anything more? This is why we want to try to provide avenues for it. While serving, while giving these things up is a sacrifice, we want to help. As we are imperfect people looking to be faithful, we want to help create these patterns in our lives, as we seek to respond to the faithfulness of God by being faithful in turn. Maybe as we look at our calendars, hard to add something regular, something once a month or twice a month. We just don't see a place for that. Well, this is where we have a great opportunity that just takes place over 1 week and one time in the year. an opportunity coming up at Kids Week. This is a really vital ministry where we have kids come from the neighborhood. A vast majority of them are not part of this church, an opportunity to help them see who God has revealed himself to be to them. And maybe we think, oh, whole week, I can't do that either. Just because it's called Kids Week, it doesn't mean that you need to be here for the whole week. We hear about that. I can't commit for the whole week. It's Kids Week, not Volunteer Week. It's they're here for the whole week. If you could be here 2 days, one day, to be part of the work God is doing, that is incredibly beneficial. Or if we just can't give time at that week, that's okay. I think of the Israelites who were gathering up wood, that they themselves were not the ones who were offering the sacrifices, but they were gathering the resources so that the work of the ministry could take place. And maybe there's something like that here. Not to gather wood. Please don't bring wood here. I don't know what we're going to do with it. But there's an equivalent of gathering wood. We have an Amazon wish list. It's on the bulletin that you have right there. There's a lot of resources that go into this vital week that we have here at the church. And just by looking at the Amazon wish list, it looks like there's a lot of fish that's needed for this week to be done well. And so it's an opportunity to be part of the work that God is doing, either by our time or by the gathering of resources. Or maybe it's joining our student ministry team. This is a really important time of the year that relationship is formed, that community is built, that is a starting point for the whole rest of the school year. And we've been praying to God to identify people to join this team, especially a woman who can help care for one of our girls' small groups there. Or life groups. It's such an important way for us to connect with people in the church. And one of the things that limits our ability to get new people plugged in here is a lack of life group leaders. Or our worship team. We read this passage, all that these people are doing to help the worship of God. All of these steps that are taking place so that they can point others to worship God. That's something that our worship team does, whether on stage or off of it. There are places for imperfect people where the perfect God works his impeccable plans through here. That there are places where we can give and serve and respond to the faithfulness of God, how we live changed, distinct lives because of him. And that gets to our final piece of distinction from this passage, that we and the Israelites are distinct in our unity. In that passage that I read for us, the word we is used 10 times. 10 times the people say, together as one, we agree on doing the same thing. We have the same focus, the same vision, the same plan in place because of who our God is. In an increasingly divided world, we are joined together on something stronger than ideology or politics or shared interest or a shared dislike of something. We are formed on the foundation of God's faithfulness. I was going to take us where I always do. I feel like I'm always quoting John 17, where what does Jesus see as so important for his people to understand? He's going to the cross. He's about to die. What is so important that he wants to get across to his people? He prays that his people be one, be united. But I'm not going to take us to John 17. I'm just going to reference it and essentially take us there without actually going there. Instead, I'm going to take us to a different place that I think captures this idea of how God has brought us together as one to be part of the work that he's doing, to be distinct people in light of who he is. This is 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 9. It says, "You are a chosen race that's distinct, a royal priesthood, distinct, a holy nation, by definition distinct, a people for his own possession, distinct, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light." You better believe that's distinct. "Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. We have been made a people. We have been made one. Where we are scattered, divided apart, God has brought us together as one because he has shown us mercy. That's what joins us. That's our background. That's our foundation. I have found mercy in God. You have found mercy in God. And because of that, that changes everything. We live this way that God's called us to. We live in light of his faithfulness. We live distinct lives because we have seen such great mercy from our God. Let me pray for us. Father, we are so grateful for the instruction, for the call that you give to us. In life, it's so difficult to know what to trust or what to do, who to follow. And you give us not just a way to be saved, not just a way that's for us to draw near to you, but you give us instruction as well. You give us guidance in this life. None of this is to earn anything. None of this is to try to just merely survive off of our efforts. But you are the God of mercy. You are the God who's revealed yourself to be faithful time and time again. You are the God who's given us all that we have. And so we live lives of response. We respond to your faithfulness by seeking to be faithful in turn. We respond to your goodness by seeking to be good in turn. We respond to the work that you've done by seeking to join in the work that you are doing, by living distinct lives, distinct in time, in money, in worship, in unity, seeking to use all that we have, all that you've given us, to respond to all that you are. So it's to you and you alone we pray. Amen.